Hi, and welcome back to Advocacy for Inclusion's Staying Connected podcast. I hope 2021's been treating you well, and I know we're all hoping that this year will be a little brighter than last year. Anyone who listened to our podcast last year knows our focus is on the issues and the stories that impact people with disability throughout Australia. AFI is a Canberra-based organisation, so we keep a particular focus on what's happening in our own territory. We spent a lot of time on COVID last year, pretty understandably, and particularly looked at the problems that were faced by people with disability, particularly during that intense period of staying at home. We also spent time looking into the work of the Disability Royal Commission. Their work continues and will continue to keep an eye on the stories that emerge through the good work of the Royal Commission, and we particularly look forward to the recommendations that are to come. The National Disability Insurance Scheme, better known as NDIS, is always on our radar. A development of particular concern this year is the impending rollout of compulsory independent assessors. The Morrison federal government has presented this development as a simpler, faster and fairer approach to assessing whether people are eligible to receive NDIS funding. Many people in the disability community, along with advocates and supporters, say otherwise. There are claims the new process will be anything but independent, that the structured approach of assessment will not be able to assess the complexity of people's circumstances and support needs, and that the assessment itself will sit outside the reach of any appeal process. Today I'm joined by Stacey Rees, Advocacy for Inclusion's Policy Team Leader. Welcome to the podcast, Stacey.
Lovely to be here.
I thought before we launch into talking about the world of NDIS and compulsory independent assessors and all of that stuff, I thought it was important to acknowledge that we're recording this conversation the day after we had massive rallies right around the country. Women of Australia and their supporters are all out in force calling for an end to entrenched misogyny, workplace and broad social inequality and violence against women. I was wondering, Stacey, if you have any thoughts or reflections about yesterday's rallies and the changes that are being called for in our country at the moment.
Yeah, I think it's an incredibly important movement, and I thought we saw such fantastic turnout of men and women across Australia yesterday. And interestingly, the Disability Royal Commission released a report following the rally last night that spoke about the experiences of people with disability and physical violence, sexual violence, stalking, and they basically said it was alarming the rates at which people with disability are also experiencing these events. People with disability are two times more likely to experience sexual violence. And the report found that nearly two-thirds or 64% of people with disability had reported experience physical or sexual violence, emotional abuse or stalking in their lifetimes. And that's just what's being reported for us. So very sobering statistics coming out of the Disability Royal Commission. And I think in light of the movement across Australia yesterday, it's something that we really need to address when the majority of people with disability are actually experiencing this kind of violence and abuse. I really hope that it's a movement that gets a lot more attention, the attention it deserves.
Absolutely. And I guess it really highlights those statistics are quite extraordinary, aren't they? That double the effect of the general community, that people with disability just have those compounding issues that they're contending with. And yeah, it really illustrates the fact that as an advocacy organisation, we really need to be part of making a noise about this issue. So yes, so thank you for that, Stacey. I thought it was really important for us to acknowledge what's going on in our country right now. We need to be part of that. So thank you.
Thank you.
All right. So getting into the nitty-gritty of NDIS and compulsory independent assessors. So I kind of always think with the podcast, it's worthwhile presuming that listeners aren't necessarily going to be across
in the IS. They're not going to necessarily understand the language of the system. So I thought it might be worthwhile to step back and to think about somebody who might be approaching the NDIS system for the first time. So let's call him arbitrarily, we'll call him Harry. So Harry is a made up person, but a person with a disability. He's heard about NDIS. He's currently living a fairly restricted life. So he's stuck at home. He has very limited opportunities to get out, involved in the community, very limited opportunities with gaining skills and finding a pathway to employment. So there's lots of restriction in his life. He's heard about NDIS and he wants to get out. He wants to get involved in the community. He wants to learn those skills. So for Harry, in approaching the NDIS, what steps is he going to have to take to actually engage with the system and hopefully get some funding?
Yeah, obviously there's a lot of interest in support from the NDIS because the supports it can bring to people to allow them to get out and participate in the community can be absolutely amazing. But it is a very complex system, so we'll try to keep it as simple as we can. But the first thing that Harry is going to need to do is to complete an access request form, and he'll have to submit information from a health professional about his disability, so that the NDIS can decide whether or not he's eligible.
Okay, so and is that a simple thing? Where if he approaches a health professional, say his GP, is the GP going to know kind of automatically what he has to do at his end to help Harry?
At the initial stage, there's just a little bit of information that's required about the disability, and the NDIA will initially consider whether or not Harry meets eligibility requirements. Following that, there's a much, much deeper look at a functional capacity for NDIS. And what that basically means is it's assessing a person's support needs, how they are able to function with and without support, to get an understanding of how much support they're going to need to achieve their goals.
Okay, so it sounds like there's an initial bit of a broad look at Harry's situation and then this functional assessment. So at the moment, who's doing that assessment? Who are the people that Harry's going to have to see to be assessed?
Yeah, so prior to the independent assessments rollout, how this works is Harry will need to see his health professionals and get them to submit some evidence about functional capacity. So if you have a think about it, it might be really clear to Harry what his functional needs are, depending on whether he uses people for support or special equipment, things like that. If there are things that he can and cannot do without assistance, that might be really clear to Harry and to the people involved in his life. But the tricky part here is providing evidence of this need to the NDIA so they can decide funding and things like that. So at the moment, Harry would need to speak to a health professional and they could submit evidence about their understanding of Harry's functional capacity. Depending on Harry's specific disability, he may be required to see certain specialists. So for different kinds of disabilities, you may need to see a different specialist who's an expert in that field who can do certain assessments. And the NDIA prefers those assessments as opposed to, say, evidence from other supports.
That all sounds, when it comes to going to particularly see specialists, that sounds like a potentially expensive process. Is that an issue for people with disability, actually being able to get those appointments in place and see specialists? Is the financial impact detrimental for people with disability at the moment?
It certainly can be. Some of the assessments that are being required by the NDIA can cost hundreds and thousands of dollars. So it can really be a huge burden for people trying to apply. And there are people who have been locked out financially from actually going through the process of providing this evidence. The other thing to consider at the moment is that there isn't a lot of clear guidance around what is needed to describe a person's functional capacity. So the NDIA needs to see evidence regarding certain categories such as self-care or self-management, mobility, communication, areas like that. And at the moment, it's not very clear for, say, a GP or a therapist who may not have a lot of involvement with the NDIA or knowledge of the NDIS system. It's not very clear to them exactly the best way to provide the relevant evidence that the NDIA needs to see in these particular categories. So we can have situations where people might go to assessments or appointments with their GPs and they try to get the right evidence and this is knocked back or it's not enough for the NDIA. And then we see people needing to go through the whole process again, booking multiple appointments and follow-ups, trying to get the right evidence without a lot of clear guidance of what that is.
It sounds like it could be an incredibly debilitating process, particularly for somebody with a disability, maybe with anxiety issues, maybe mental health issues more broad. Are we seeing, as an advocacy organisation, are we seeing the detrimental impact of this current system in terms of the people having to go through hoops continually?
Definitely. The other thing to consider is that people going through this process often don't have the supports they need. That's exactly why they're applying for the NDIS, because they are struggling with their functioning at the moment. So they often don't have adequate supports to be getting out into the community and undertaking multiple assessments and meeting appointments and things like that. So it is a really difficult process for people.
It's kind of catch-22. It's like, prove that you need support by going through a situation where you need support, but you don't have it.
Absolutely. And a lot of our work has involved supporting people through the application process.
Okay. So the federal government, I think, certainly in terms of the way they're framing things, the way they're presenting things, they're acknowledging that the expense and the difficulties of the system are problematic.
Yeah, there's been reviews and recommendations made about how to improve the implementation of the NDIS. And certainly we've seen inconsistencies in how the NDIS has been rolled out and people's experiences with it. So we share concerns about the current implementation.
So this kind of brings us to the independent assessors, and they're soon to be compulsory independent assessors. The government's basically presenting this idea as being one that will be fairer because everyone will go through the same assessment process. And I understand it's not going to cost the person with disability anything to actually be assessed. So that's presented as a benefit. And so we've got simplicity, uniformity, and a faster process, they're claiming. To me, when I look at it on the surface, it kind of sounds like an improvement, but it obviously has a lot of problems with it because we've heard from the community of people with disability and advocacy organisations that this idea is problematic. So, Stacey, can you unpack what are the problems with this supposed improvement to the system?
Yeah, so there has been widespread and consistent pushback to the idea of independent assessments from disability organisations and people with disabilities and their representatives across Australia. So there is a lot of concern about the rollout of independent assessments. I guess the first concern has been the lack of consultation with people with disabilities, and that's really been seen through the first trial program with the independent assessments, which involved a small number of people. In the first trial of independent assessments, there's very few people completed the feedback for the NDIA. And as it turns out, only 6% of the participants involved in the trial program were people with disabilities who provided feedback.
Okay, that's pretty problematic. So there's really very little to no evidence that this is a successful process at the moment.
So coming out of that trial program, only 35 people in total with disability provided feedback about their experience of being assessed through the independent assessments. There was also feedback provided by carers and families, but it was still a very small amount of people for a policy that's going to be rolled out to affect over 400,000 people with disability under the NDIS.
It's a pretty broad jump, isn't it, to go from a very small test pool with a very limited feedback to a sudden implementation across the board. So there's been feedback to the government about the inadequacies of the trial process?
Yeah, certainly. That's one of the issues that has been raised through further consultation with the NDIA. The NDIA has opened opportunities for consultation with disability organisations and people with disability. In the consultations with the NDIA, the scope was very limited and the feedback requested was not so much about whether independent assessments are a good idea or a good approach, but rather that they have been implemented and how should they be implemented. And I think we need to take a step back and listen to the feedback that's been received that's really about the significant concerns in these approaches. And we really need to pause the rollout of the independent assessments and actually take on that feedback and engage with people with disabilities about their concerns. So the other concerns include that these independent assessments go well beyond recommendations that have been relied on by the NDIA in rolling them out. So there's a couple of reviews that provided recommendations that said independent assessments could be looked at in the future for the NDIS. The scope of the proposed independent assessments goes well beyond anything that was proposed in those recommendations. For example, independent assessments are being made mandatory, and that was never a recommendation. And what that means is that every person who is found eligible for the NDIA and receives funding will be assessed with the independent assessments. Despite already providing evidence about their functioning capacity, they will be reassessed.
So somebody who's in the system at the moment who has their funding package, they're also going to have to go through this compulsory independent assessment.
Yeah, the independent assessments will also be used at sort of critical life stages. Each time funding is reviewed, if someone has a plan review or a change of circumstances, the independent assessments will be used to assess their functioning. And each time those are used, there is the possibility that funding will be reconsidered.
Do we know, in terms of just the practicality of the assessment process, the time frame for a person doing the assessment and where it happens, what details do we know about the assessment process at the moment that's being used?
Yeah, so the assessments will be done by independent assessors who are on tender by the NDIA. So there is a lot of concern about the actual level of independence that can be achieved through that sort of system. At the end of the day, the independent assessors are contracted by the NDIA. So we know that they will have certain criteria that they need to meet in that regards. The independent assessors themselves won't necessarily have specific disability knowledge or experience for the people who they're assessing. The tools have actually been designed so that this sort of specific knowledge isn't necessary, we're told.
I mean, that just seems extraordinary to me in terms of the complexity of people's disabilities and the range of issues that they're dealing with, that somebody with potentially without a disability background, certainly without knowledge of the specific disability of the person they're meeting, is making a major assessment about this person's support needs. It really does strike me as being inadequate.
I mean, you could have situations where, say, a physical therapist is providing the assessment of someone with autism or a psychosocial disability, and they won't necessarily have any specific knowledge of that person's circumstances or the way their disability affects them before walking into the room to assess them. So another concern with the independent assessments is the use of standardised tools. Some of the assessment tools that have been used by the NDIS were never supposed to, haven't been designed for the purpose of assessing function in relation to funding of support needs. So we've got untrialed and untested tools that are going to be rolled out to everyone. there's been some inconsistencies shown in the evaluation of the first pilot program in regards to the assessment tools, where up to 8% of participants involved in that program were actually found to have high functioning in the sort of normal range. So that's got some concerning implications. These were 95% of the people involved in the first program were already NDIS participants. So this would suggest there's some discrepancies between the independent assessments and the eligibility and functional capacity criteria that was already being used by the NDIS. The evaluation of the pilot program suggested that these people would be more likely to use early intervention support rather than ongoing lifetime supports provided by the NDIS. And this discrepancies between the tools hasn't been thoroughly explored or explained. So it does raise concerns that when they're rolled out further, how many people who are already participants might be found to have a high range of functioning.
So, and presumably that means there'd be potentially less funding for those people if they're found to be at a higher level of functioning.
Yeah, as the results of the independent assessments are going to be used as the main source to decide funding for people's plans, if the results are out or if they're not comprehensive, then there is a real risk that if they're underestimating a person's needs, funding will be directly related to those results and a person might not be adequately funded for their needs.
Do we have any sense that the basic flaw of this assessment process is that it's failing to capture the complexities of people with disability, the complexities of the nature of their disability itself and maybe related issues?
Absolutely. That's the major concern with independent assessments, that it's a very limited time frame of maybe 3 hours using standardized assessment tools that haven't been specifically designed for people with diverse needs and complex needs, being utilized by someone who doesn't have specific disability experience or knowledge of the person that they're working with. It seems really problematic to think that someone's going to capture comprehensively the diverse needs for someone's daily support within that limited interaction.
Do we know with the assessment process, is the individual who's being assessed able to have support with him or her during that process, or maybe other voices who can add to the perspective of the assessment?
Yeah, and that's an interesting element of the assessments as well. The assessments actually seem to require another person to speak on behalf of the person with disability at some stage during the assessment. So information released by the NDIA refers to things like asking the participant to leave the room while an assessment is conducted with their support person. So this might be a family member or a carer. But this is a real concern for people who are isolated or don't have close relationships. If you have a think about just who would understand comprehensively your needs better than yourself?
Absolutely. It's quite striking that the person has to leave the room. It seems to contradict certainly everything that we would insist on in terms of people with disability being in the room when it comes to decisions being made about their lives. Is there any justification for that element in the process?
The NDIA information does seem quite limited in terms of this. To the best of our understanding, it seems like it's a requirement to have another person involved in the assessment in some way, to the point that if a person with disability can't identify a person who would be suitable for this assessment, the NDIA does offer to help them find someone. Now, we're not sure if that means something like contacting an advocacy organisation to have someone you haven't met before come in and speak about your needs, but that's definitely a very significant concern for us.
I suppose as much as the present system is imperfect, at least people are likely to be assessed by a GP or by a health professional who actually knows them and knows something of the complexities they're contending with.
Many people with disability have already established relationships with trusted health professionals and supports who would be able to give this information. We may have people who've worked with their doctors or their supports for years to understand the different impacts of their disabilities and to understand how that affects them. And by using independent assessments, we're basically losing that knowledge by not giving it the priority in terms of actually understanding someone's functional capacity.
Looking at the inadequacies of what's going to be imposed, what do you see as the real agenda of putting in place these independent assessors? What's the driver for this change?
So we know from the information released by the NDIA that these new measures have been directly linked with the financial sustainability of the NDIS as it's ongoing. And it's difficult to see other reasons why they would take such major measures that go beyond the scope of recommendations to implement these independent assessments if there wasn't some pressure to meet financial goals.
Okay, so what we have with these independent assessors coming on board, the government is presenting it as establishing a fairer system of eradicating individuals with disability having to pay money to be assessed. But then in reality, we can see there's deficiencies with this new process, and there really is this underlying money-saving motivation happening.
Potentially. I mean, it has been linked with financial sustainability of the program, and we would question exactly how much this does lift the financial burden of people with disabilities, given that they will still need to provide evidence regarding the disability to prove eligibility. That does mean that for a lot of people, they will have to engage with professionals and undergo assessments to be able to meet that eligibility criteria. So there is still that financial burden that they're facing. So further to that, the independent assessments don't actually provide support recommendations from this assessment. It basically provides an assessment of functional capacity. But what previously happened was people would seek assessments from occupational therapists and so on, who would assess their functional capacity and then also provide support recommendations. So they would say, this person, Harry, maybe would have his functioning assessed, and then they would say Harry would benefit from 4 hours of therapy per week or the provision of a support worker to do so on, or from the provision of certain equipment. These independent assessments don't actually provide any support recommendations. So if anyone is interested in receiving that guidance of what support they should actually be accessing through the NDIS, then they're still going to have to go and pay for a functional assessment just like they did previously.
Okay, so the argument that this is saving people's money is actually a bit of a furphy. It's a bit of a red herring.
It's questionable just how much money it is going to save people. And there would be certain cohorts of people who we think would be more disadvantaged by this. So say people with mental health conditions, a lot of those need to be more thoroughly explored to be able to develop the evidence required by the NDIA to prove eligibility. So potentially they're going to face further financial costs of sourcing assessments and accessing specialists anyway. And there would be a lot of people who wouldn't necessarily require support recommendations coming from their functional assessments, who might be quite savvy at researching or have other contacts to be able to decide how they would spend their NDIS funding. But a lot of people really do rely on that guidance from a health professional or from their other supports to decide how best to utilise their funding and what sort of support they need.
Basically, we've got two systems. We've got the current system, organising assessment off your own bat, and the new system with the compulsory assessors. But then, of course, it's more complicated than that, because in terms of actually establishing, working out your support needs, you're still needing to have conversations with health professionals and various other agencies. So two imperfect systems. As advocacy organisations, I guess, we can sometimes be accused of finding fault with everything, but not actually proposing anything solid or helpful in terms of how we can actually improve a situation. Stacey, I'm going to throw it onto you now. How can we get a better system that works for people as they approach NDIS and get their assessments and sort out the support needs they need? How are we going to make the system better, Stacey? It's all on your head now.
No worries, Rob. Let's solve the NDIS.
Yes, right now we're going to do
all
it.
Solve the implementation issues. Well, we were given some recommendations. And while the NDIA has gone beyond the scope of those recommendations, the TUNE review, for example, suggested sort of discretionary independent assessments. So it was proposed more as an opt-in option of people who were really having trouble finding that evidence or who needed a bit more support to establish their functional capacity. It seems a bit unnecessary to make it mandatory for everyone. If some people already possess the evidence of their functional capacity, it seems a bit inefficient to be making independent assessments mandatory for everyone, but certainly it could have been an opt-in option. Another thing that might have been considered would be clearer guidance for health professionals around the requirements for the NDIS. So they're actually working on prioritising guidance to GPs at the moment about establishing evidence for eligibility. So it's possible that clearer guidance provided to GPs and more resources and training about the NDIS actually could have improved the ability of already established and trusted health professionals in providing the evidence that was required by the NDIA. Potentially, people's own health professionals could have also done these assessments themselves. So the assessments were done by someone who has an established and trusted relationship with a person with disability, knowledge of the impacts that they're facing, ones who would be able to explore a bit further, a bit more comprehensively, the impact of the disability. Now, there's also options for Medicare rebates for NDIS assessments and things like that, and just assistance with that funding if the financial burden is what they're really hoping to lift there.
Okay, so there's a range of possible options to improve the system without having everybody off to a compulsory independent assessor with all the problems of that system.
It certainly did seem, and especially this is the feedback that is being received by the NDIA now, that there could have been potentially a few other options before quite moving to this measure.
Okay. So we've been talking about the independent assessors. That's not the only upcoming development in the world of NDIS. What else is coming up in terms of changes to the system that are kind of on your radar and potentially problematic?
Now, this is a difficult question, Rob, because we don't have a lot of information about the changes coming to NDIS. So we can speculate. We're certainly concerned about potential changes coming, but there hasn't been a lot of communication from the NDIA about exactly what changes are coming. They have opened the door to legislative reform, and there is concern that Minister Roberts in particular has spoken about adjusting the reasonable and necessary guidelines of the NDIS Act and potentially limiting them somewhat. So there's...
Do we have any details about that in terms of what's the nature of the limitations that he's talking about or any examples of that?
One example that Minister Roberts has spoken about that got a lot of media attention recently was in regards to the use of sex therapies under the NDIS. Minister Roberts has made it clear, and in information coming from the NDIA, it's been made clear that they will try to restrict the use of NDIS funding for sex therapies and things of that nature.
Okay. So, and what's been the community response, that position of the minister?
There's already a lot of criteria in the NDIS Act that restricts exactly what is considered reasonable and necessary for funding under the NDIS. So there's a lot of concern that there might be moral or political considerations being taken into account in terms of deciding for people with disability what should be considered reasonable and necessary. And this comes back to a lack of consultation with people with disabilities and their representative organisations. And it's a question of who should have control over deciding what is or is not a reasonable or necessary support for someone with a disability.
Absolutely. It's certainly a system that should be informed by the views and experiences of people with disability. Their voices need to be heard in determining the nature and direction of this system. It's highly problematic that the system's being used in a kind of morally directive way in terms of people's freedom in what they're wanting in their lives. It certainly sounds as though there are changes. We don't know what they're going to necessarily be, but they need to be on the radar. And Stacey, I can't think of anybody better to keep her eyes on the radar with all of this than yourself. I look forward to talking to you again soon in our podcast. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you. It was good fun.